Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Since taking office, Donald Trump and his administration, most notably his EPA head, Scott Pruitt, have declared war on climate science. So what has the administration done so far? Well, they've placed climate deniers, oil and gas executives, and lobbyists in top government positions. According to a new report by the Environmental Data and Governance Initiative, mentions of climate change have been removed, altered, or played down on EPA and other federal government agency websites. And over the past year, the EPA has been busy undoing a slew of life-saving regulations. The administration has pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement and has opened nearly the entire coast to offshore drilling. Today's guest, climate scientist Michael Mann, says this is the most anti-science and anti-environmental administration in history. Michael Mann is professor of atmospheric science at Penn State and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. He's the author of three books, including his most recent, The Madhouse Effect: How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. He co-authored that with Tom Tolles. And Michael Mann joins me in studio. Hi, Michael. Thank you for coming in.
Great to be with you.
It's great to have you in studio. There's so much to talk about. I only mentioned a slice of what is happening under this administration. As a scientist and someone who dedicates your life to these issues, how are you reflecting back on what has happened so far?
Well, it's obviously disturbing to somebody who cares about an informed societal discourse over matters of policy-relevant science. In my case, I have studied the science of climate change for decades. I've done all that I can to try to inform the worthy debate about what to do about this problem. But what is most troubling about the current administration is sort of the rejection of fact-based discourse. Truly the world of alternative facts and fake news, where you have an administration that, as you have already alluded to, is staffed with individuals who reject the overwhelming scientific evidence that climate change is real and a threat. And they reject it primarily because it goes against their interests. They primarily come from the world of fossil fuel industry, where the science of climate change represents a threat to their bottom line as they see it, because it does tell us that we have to move away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. And so rather than engage in the worthy debate about policy, what to do about this problem, they're simply doing all they can to bury the evidence under the rug, to literally outlaw the discussion of climate change. In the state of Florida, for example, Governor Rick Scott has essentially outlawed the use of terms like climate change or global warming, and he's part of a larger effort here. The Trump administration, as you said, is primarily staffed with individuals who come from the fossil fuel industry, who are lobbyists or executives. The Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, is the former CEO of the world's most powerful and largest fossil fuel corporation, ExxonMobil. And so it's not simply a matter of the fox guarding the hen house, as it were. It's the fox now renting out rooms to fellow foxes. And it makes it very difficult to make progress at the federal level. The good news is that there is still progress taking place, at the local level, at the state level. California in particular is sort of a leading light when it comes to, governments acting on this threat.
What would you say at this point concerns you the most?
The rejection of facts, the idea that people are entitled to their own facts. Of course, the famous saying, Daniel P. Moynihan, the former senator of New York, you're entitled to your own opinions but not your own facts. We now live in a world where many people do feel that they're entitled to their own facts, and it's extremely difficult to have a good faith discussion about how to move forward when one side is essentially rejecting reality. They're rejecting the facts. There's a total lack of good faith there, and that lack of good faith makes it difficult to find common ground.
I wonder, when we look at the EPA and all of these agencies that do such important work, can you describe, for example, why these agencies are so important? A lot of us know about the EPA, but a lot of people don't really know much about NOAA or the Department of Interior, or what kind of work is actually done in these agencies, and also how the funding works.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are experts. These agencies are staffed with career professionals who understand the underlying science. They understand the challenges that we face when it comes to, you know, our public lands and our national parks. And of course, that's the domain of the Department of Interior, which is now led by Ryan Zinke, who is essentially just a mouthpiece for fossil fuel interests who want to sell off our public lands to the highest bidder and to mine them for fossil fuels and to destroy these precious spaces that have been preserved for a century or two centuries. Then you have, again, the EPA, Scott Pruitt. The EPA is tasked with preserving our environment, with enforcing regulations that are there to protect our water, to protect our air, regulations that were put in place by both Republican and Democratic administrations over the last half century. And what we're seeing right now is literally the dismantling of these environmental protections that were put there by Republicans and Democrats alike. So NOAA, is tasked with monitoring our oceans and our atmosphere, understanding not just weather, but climate, because stakeholders of all sorts depend on reliable information, whether, it's the armed forces and the Navy or the shipping industry when it comes to, tropical storms. And we've seen this last season, just mm-hmm. how devastating these more ferocious hurricanes that we're dealing with are. NOAA plays a very important role in doing the forecasting and helping stakeholders prepare for these, coming storms and preparing for the long term, understanding the longer term risks and adapting to them and building resilient infrastructure. That's what they're tasked with doing. They're tasked with basically defending us and against threats to our environment, be they natural or human-made. And what we're seeing is literally the dissolution of those entities, death by attrition, an effort to starve them of the resources that are necessary for them to do their job, for them to do this job of protecting us.
The list is so long, but this administration has even repealed the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which is the most powerful and important bird protection law ever passed. This marks the centennial of the act, and National Geographic dedicated their latest magazine to birds, and it's beautiful. But sometimes you just have to say, what? They're even repealing the Migratory Bird Treaty Act?
It almost feels like satire. It feels surreal. Just an almost comical rejection of any notion of preserving nature and preserving our environment. And it defies what you would think it means to be a conservative. There was a time when being conservative meant conserving our environment. And now those who call themselves conservatives are engaged in an effort to sell off our environment to the highest bidder, to basically sell, away the future of our children and grandchildren to polluting interests who are trying to make a quick short-term dollar. And, of course, the administration that's in power is led by a president who sees the presidency as a way to increase his own personal wealth. So why should it be a surprise that he sees the role of government to be to increase his personal wealth and the wealth of the corporate fat cats that, you know, whose bidding his administration is doing.
Today we are speaking with climate scientist Michael Mann. He's professor of atmospheric science at Penn State and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. In 2016, at the end of the year, he wrote a piece for the Washington Post called "I'm a Scientist Who Has Gotten Death Threats. I Fear What May Happen Under Trump." And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. We're actually recording this, Michael. You're in town to receive an award, a climate communication award, which is really important because we've had your colleague Naomi Oreskes on and others on who say that scientists need to do a better job of communicating to the public about why this is important. But also, when you're talking about something like climate change, to explain it in a way where a lot of people can understand it. And it cannot be used like it has been used by climate deniers to say the exact opposite.
Yeah, the challenges are unique when it comes to communicating environmental science. Climate change, of course, being in the domain of environmental science, because it's hard enough just to communicate science in the first place. Often it's technical, and scientists are taught to speak in jargon not necessarily to think or explain things in a way that's digestible to people who don't have the background that they have. So it starts out being enough of a challenge just to communicate science to the public if you're a scientist. Here, when it comes to climate change or any other area within the environmental sciences, you add on to that the stiff headwind that you face of a very well-funded effort to disinform the public, to confuse the public, and to confuse policymakers, and it adds that much more difficulty to the task of communicating the science, because you have this echo chamber that has been created by conservative interests and those who do their bidding, that is aimed at confusing the public discourse, that is aimed at confusing people about, what the facts actually are when it comes to climate change.
And this is so important. We did a show about that amazing documentary, Merchants of Doubt. And some people who are in the business of lying to the public were in the film proudly talking about why they do it and why they're so successful at it. Now, after the election, the media did a lot of soul searching, saying that, they needed to be truth tellers and figure out what they got wrong. And, when you think about climate denial and this massive million, maybe billion dollar industry that is feeding lies to the public, this is why the media are so important. Under the Trump administration, have you seen a shift in how the media cover climate change? I mean, in the past, in the name of, quote, balance, they would bring you on with one of these paid climate deniers. And they wouldn't tell the viewer that Bob over here is paid by Exxon and Chevron. They would just put you on equal footing. Do you think that's changed since the election?
Well, I think it's changed not so much since the election. I think there has been this evolution towards getting away from this false balance, the idea that you have to give an equal place at the table to a scientist who's representing the overwhelming consensus of the world scientists on an issue, and some, industry-funded lobbyist whose interest is in sowing doubt and confusion. I think there has slowly been this recognition that that's not an appropriate way to litigate a matter where there are objective facts, especially when the stakes are as great as they are in the case of climate change. That having been said, there hasn't been that much discussion in sort of our mainstream media of climate change as an issue. Part of that, I suppose, has to do with the fact that we have other scandals that have really sort of sucked the oxygen out of the news cycle. Every day, there are any number of outlandish things that the Trump administration has said or done. And so an issue like climate change, which is more nuanced and requires more context, has that gets short thrift in an environment where it's just about the latest scandal. Now, some of these scandals do actually involve the environment, and there is an opportunity to talk about climate change. And not every media outlet has done a good job in taking advantage of that opportunity. There are some that have. The Guardian, newspaper, has really made climate a forefront issue in their coverage. The MSNBC has a number of shows where climate change has been featured. CNN actually did a wonderful segment about a month ago on the melting Arctic, and I played a role in that particular piece. So there are good people within all these news organizations that are fighting to give a voice to, the issue of climate change. But the competition is just so fierce against everything else that we're dealing with. It's just this constant onslaught. And it's a real challenge.
With all of the horrific disasters we've been facing, the fires, extremely cold weather in the East Coast, the mudslides that are happening in Southern California, how do you think the media should include climate change in that coverage? Of course, there are a lot of unanswered questions, but there are also a lot of answered questions. And what I see is they will interview people who survived, interview people who saved someone, first responders, and they're feel good. I mean, those are very important stories, of course, but I see that the climate change aspect of it is often missing.
Yeah, no, that's right. And again, it's the constant challenge of, of competing with, the immediacy of, as the disaster plays out, competing with sort of the real-time disaster with a story that is much more contextual in nature and is about the longer-term emerging threat. That having been said, there is a direct tie-in. The unprecedented heat waves and droughts and superstorms that we've seen over the last several years, there is a linkage and there is a context for understanding what's happening that relates to human-caused climate change. And so there are those opportunities to provide that context. And some media outlets have tried to do that, but too many have just not really made an effort to provide that context. And I have to think that some of that has to do with, when you look at many of the cable news outlets and you look at their advertising, so much of it is the American Petroleum Institute and ExxonMobil. And is there implicit pressure to not cover a topic that might be inconvenient to the vested interests who are funding these organizations through their advertising dollars? You have to wonder if that's part of the problem as well.
Koch Industries is a big funder.
Absolutely.
Not only of media, but art institutions and many programs across the country.
Yeah, and including science museums. And one of the scandals that has played out in recent years has been, David Koch and his funding of exhibits at the American Museum of Natural History, the Smithsonian Institute, and the troubling fact that some of those exhibits soft pedal or downplay the threat of climate change. Is there a quid pro quo? Has that firewall that's supposed to exist between the funders and the content, has that broken down?
What is the conversation among scientists about this issue? The Kochs, for example, funding museums or giving money to college campuses?
Yeah, it's very troubling to many of us. And so I think if you talk to academics and you talk to scientists in general, they're troubled by the increased tendency for these institutions to take money from the Koch brothers when there's a clear conflict of interest. They have a vested interest in preventing the communication of the reality of climate change to the public, and they have spent millions of dollars polluting our public discourse when it comes to human-caused climate change. And so to accept their money is to grant them license, is to grant them credibility and the imprimatur of our hallowed institutions. They are buying credibility, and academic institutions and museums are happily selling it to them.
To talk more about university campuses, an NPR investigation found that there are an increasing number of researchers who are trying not to use the word climate change in their titles because they're afraid that their funding will get cut.
Yeah, I mean, that's troubling as well. The self-censorship, the widespread knowledge now that this administration has taken an adversarial position with respect to climate change. The funding agencies have been told to steer clear of funding of climate science, or steer the agencies, their own staff scientists have been told to steer clear of researching themselves. You know, issues related to climate change, and so in an environment where their precious few resources to support scientific research, investigators in that environment too often are willing to to dilute their message, to steer clear of using language, using terms like climate change or global warming in their grant proposals. In many cases, I think they're doing that under the notion that, well, this is what they need to do to get funded. And once they get funded, well, they can just do the research that they were going to do anyways. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some tendency for scientists to convince themselves that this isn't co-opting their research. They're just changing the way that they've described it and changing the keywords that are flagged in their proposals. But I think it has a chilling effect. And I think that ultimately it does have this effect of steering researchers away from hard-hitting questions about hard-hitting, you know, research about the impacts of climate change. And so I find it disturbing. I think it's pernicious, and I think it's just one of the many ways in which this current administration is trying to chill scientific discourse and research about topics that they find inconvenient, like climate change.
And it's affected their research.
There's no doubt that when you're funded to do something, then the funding managers will hold you responsible. So if your proposal that was funded doesn't mention climate change, doesn't mention global warming, and you do research that is published that is clearly about global warming and climate change, the funding manager may come back and say you're not doing what you were funded to do. So I think it's naive to think that you can change the way you frame or describe your science to get funded and then do what you were going to do anyways. It doesn't work out that way.
Today we're speaking with Michael Mann, professor of atmospheric science at Penn State and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. He's the author of 3 books, including his latest, The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy, which he co-authored with Tom Tolles. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. It's also our One Planet series. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. It's been 45 years since the Supreme Court decided the landmark Roe v. Wade case, which legalized abortion in the U.S. and gave women more control over their reproductive choices. The decision also lifted many women out of poverty. Since then, Republicans have enacted extreme policies that restrict access to abortion and other reproductive care. On the next Your Call, we'll speak with women who remember what life was like when abortion was illegal. Join the conversation with me, Rose Aguilar. And you.
That'll be tomorrow morning at 10.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today it is our One Planet series, and we are speaking with Michael Mann, professor of atmospheric science at Penn State. His most recent book is The Madhouse Effect, which he co-authored with Tom Tolles. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. We are recording this with Michael Mann as he is in town to receive an award for outstanding climate science communication. This is so important, especially in this climate. Before the break, Michael, we were talking about how the media include or don't include information about climate change in stories about the fires, the horrible cold weather. I can't even imagine. I mean, I saw photos of frozen iguanas in Florida. It was so cold. And the floods in Southern California. When you look at those issues specifically, what new information are we learning about the climate?
Yeah.
Let's take cold weather first.
Yeah.
What are we learning?
See, and that's one of the more subtle impacts. And so some of the impacts are obvious. Heat waves, drought, unprecedented flooding events. These are all things that are pretty straightforward manifestations of the science of climate change, things that we predicted long in advance, and we're seeing them play out. But there are also more subtle features of the climate system. You know, the critics like to say, well, there's uncertainty, so we shouldn't act on this problem because there's scientific uncertainty, when in fact the uncertainty often has cut against us in the sense that we're learning things now that we didn't know, that we didn't understand, that speak to the fact that there are impacts that we didn't anticipate and that are playing out and are already taking a great toll on us. It isn't a subtle problem anymore. The impacts of climate change are no longer subtle. We're seeing them play out in various forms of extreme damaging weather events. Now, when it comes to the extreme cold that we've seen this winter and several other recent winters in the eastern U.S., that is part of a particular pattern that the jet stream has tended to take. And it's the same pattern that gives us warm and relatively dry weather in the winter over California that gives us this unusually cold weather back east, because mm-hmm. what's happening is the jet stream is tending to veer north of California, denying it that moisture, that rainfall, and that snowfall that California relies upon for its water needs. And as that jet stream meanders north, the jet stream is a wave. It tends to veer in one direction in one place and then go in the other direction somewhere else. So it veers north over California in the western U.S., and then it turns around and comes crashing down towards the southern United States in the east. And so that same jet stream pattern that has been giving us drought in California has given us some unusual cold in the eastern U.S. Now, there are scientists, including some scientists here in the Bay Area. Noah Diffenbaugh of Stanford University has led a number of studies that have shown that pattern of the jet stream is actually favored by climate change. It may be becoming more frequent because of climate change, and it has to do with subtle effects like when you melt sea ice in the Arctic. What happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. That can actually impact the behavior of the Northern Hemisphere jet stream. And in fact, more than a decade ago, 12 years ago, another Northern California scientist, Lisa Sloan of UC Santa Cruz, published a study that suggested back in 2004, I think it was, that melting Arctic sea ice would likely lead the jet stream to exhibit this pattern that creates drought in California. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what's happened. But at the time, that was very controversial. And only now is there starting to be a consensus that's building that there is this relationship. So as counterintuitive or even paradoxical as it might seem, the fact that we've seen extreme cold in the eastern United States does not disprove global warming, as the critics would like you to think. It may be a manifestation of some of the more subtle impacts that climate change is having. So it's still warming. Winters are still warming in the eastern U.S., and we're seeing far more warm records than we're seeing cold records in the eastern U.S. But that doesn't mean we won't have episodes of acute cold. And that's what we seem to be seeing. It may be a manifestation of this unusual jet stream pattern that is being favored by climate change.
What does the science say about what's to come? Because December in the Bay Area felt unreasonably warm. And luckily, we just got a couple days of rain. But yeah. I have to remind myself that this is January and we haven't had much rain at all.
Well, look at what's played out in Southern California, in particular Santa Barbara and the surrounding region, mm-hmm. where we've had extreme summer drought. And there was a brief respite from that drought last winter because it was a fairly wet winter. But by summer, we had gone back into that drought pattern. Earlier summers, hotter summers, more evaporation of moisture. So inevitably, that leads us to more widespread drought in regions like California, especially Southern California. But that drought is punctuated by short-term episodes of very heavy rainfall. So when you do get a storm, the atmosphere is warmer than it used to be, so there's more moisture in the air. And when conditions are conducive to rising motion, which is what happens within storms, you can actually squeeze more water out of the atmosphere, and you get greater amounts of rainfall. So ironically, this pattern of warmth and drought and wildfire. And what does the wildfire do? It destroys the vegetation. It destroys the integrity of the of the soil and of the land, and that created the sort of the conditions that allowed these massive landslides, where you got these very heavy precipitation events. So when the rainfall did happen, it came in larger amounts over a shorter period of time, which makes it more difficult actually to replenish water supplies when it falls in these very extreme short-term episodes, and it creates havoc like we saw with these deadly landslides in Southern California. So these sorts of episodes give us a vision of what we're likely to see far more of in the future if we go down this road of continuing to burn fossil fuels and increase the concentrations of these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
What about the horrific hurricanes we saw in the Caribbean last year?
So I've done some research in this area. There's an emerging consensus. There's some debate about will we see more tropical storms or fewer tropical storms in the Atlantic. One thing where there does appear to be an emerging consensus is that we're going to see stronger hurricanes. The strongest hurricanes will become stronger, and they are becoming stronger. There's actually a measurable trend where there's a roughly 10-mile-per-hour increase in the maximum sustained winds of the strongest storms, and that's a very robust trend. We expect this theoretically. Warmer oceans, it's the warmth from the evaporating water off the surface of these warm tropical oceans that provides the energy to strengthen these storms. And there's some pretty straightforward principles. It's essentially thermodynamics, basic thermodynamics, physics, that tells us the warmer that ocean surface, the more energy, the more intensification. And empirically, they appear to be increasing at a rate of about 10 miles per hour for each degree Fahrenheit of warming of the ocean surface. Now, that may not sound that large, 7% increase in wind speeds, but the destructive potential of a hurricane goes as the third power of the wind speed. So that means that 7% increase in wind speed translates to a 20% increase in the destructive potential of those storms. That's not a small signal. That's not a subtle signal. That's something you expect to see, and we are seeing it. Over the last 3 years, we've seen the strongest storm ever, strongest hurricane ever. Wow. On the face of the earth, Hurricane Patricia in the Pacific, we've seen the strongest storm in the Pacific and the open Atlantic with Irma this last season, strongest storm in the northern hemisphere, strongest storm in the southern hemisphere. That was Winston that hit Fiji. So we're seeing it in the data. We expected this to happen. It's happening. And it isn't just the damage by the winds. It's, again, simple thermodynamics, warmer ocean, more evaporation of moisture. You have more moisture in the atmosphere, you can get larger amounts of rainfall. So, for example, Harvey, when that system stalled over Houston, we saw record levels of rainfall, flooding rainfall, several feet, devastating. Climate change played a role there. In fact, there's now a study that shows it's very unlikely we would have seen the extent of flooding that we saw in the absence of climate change.
Wow. Today we're joined by Michael Mann, professor of atmospheric science at Penn State and author of three books, including The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. He co-wrote this book with Tom Tolles. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take your phone calls. Michael Mann is in town to receive an award for outstanding climate science communication. And he, like many scientists, are writing about the threats that they've received, death threats in Michael's case. He wrote a piece in the Washington Post fearing what may happen under Donald Trump. Sticking with the science and what we know now about hurricanes and floods, it's shocking to see this happening right now. And I have to wonder, I mean, we're going to see some major changes in our lifetimes. I mean, forget the next 20 years, but what about the next 5 years if we continue on this path?
You sometimes hear people say, well, you know, it's a new normal, right? And it's not, because a new normal implies that you arrive in some stable, new atmosphere, environment. And that's not what's happening. We expect the heat waves to become more intense, longer duration. We expect worsened drought in the Pacific Southwest. We expect even stronger and more flooding storms in the future. The more we warm the planet, the worse these impacts become. So it isn't just like we get more of what we see today. what we see today is just sort of the veritable tip of the iceberg in terms of what we may see in the future if we continue down this road. Mm. The good news being that there is still time to make decisions that don't take us down that road. But that window of opportunity is shrinking, and we can't afford 4 years of inaction on climate change.
Well, Trump will be in office. Let's say he's impeached. You're going to get Mike Pence. So things are not going to change, especially on the climate. So 3 years of this, of rolling back regulations, placing people in these very important positions that have zero experience, giving industry everything it wants. As a scientist, 3 more years of not taking action, how will that affect what we're about to deal with?
It would be devastating just in what we're seeing, just the dismantling of environmental protections and progress on climate change at the executive level that we've seen over the 1 year of Trumpism. You can imagine what 3 more years would give us. Fortunately, you know, the one thing that can change is the degree, the level of congressional oversight. Congress plays the role of oversight when it comes to the executive branch of government. And right now, of course, that is broken down because there's a complicity between a Republican Congress that is doing the bidding of the same special interests that the administration is doing. So what people can do, of course, is come out and vote in the midterm elections. And you know, if the House were to change hands, and especially the House and the Senate, then what we would likely see would be real oversight when it comes to nominations of anti-science, anti-environmental officials to government-level positions, when it comes to policy on climate change. If we can see a return of congressional oversight, then we can sort of stem, you know, the damage being done, and people have an opportunity to do that in less than a year.
In terms of specific policy changes, let's say that you were able to make the decisions. When we do shows about the environment and I ask guests, what would you change? Give me specifics. Sometimes it's hard to get that. And you try to do a good job of explaining these things so anyone can understand it and you can share it with family and friends. What changes at this point would you like to see, like the top three?
So what I'd like to see first and foremost would be a price on carbon. We are making progress. You know, there's this trend, this inevitable trend, you know, and here in California, you really see it, away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. That's the direction that the world is moving. It's the direction that the U.S. will ultimately move in. It's simply a question of how quickly do we move in that direction. We would get to where we need to be just allowing, you know, the technology and the market to move in the direction it's already moving. The problem is, if we don't accelerate that process, then we will burn through our carbon budget. We will burn more carbon than is necessary to warm the planet beyond what we sometimes call the dangerous level of 2 degrees Celsius warming, where we really start to see the worst impacts of climate change, irreversible changes in our climate. So in order to avoid crossing the dangerous limit, we need to accelerate the transition that's already underway away from fossil fuels. And the way you do that is by leveling the marketplace. You need to somehow put in place a price signal that tells the market about the damage that the burning of fossil fuels is doing to us, is doing to our lives, is doing to our health, our ability, our food costs, water availability. There's a real economic toll that the damage of climate change is doing. And you need to make sure that that is incorporated through a price signal, a price on carbon that allows renewable energy that isn't creating the same damages to compete fairly. What we're seeing instead right now under the Trump administration is this perverse opposite incentive system where the incentives are all going to fossil fuels and not to renewable energy. We need the opposite of that. We need to level the playing field so fossil fuel energy can compete.
What would you say to critics on this carbon plan who say, a lot of people criticize this by just saying, well, you're just charging these incredibly profitable companies. You're just charging them to pollute, right?
Well, you know, there. If you talk to leading economists, they'll tell you that this really works. Mm-hmm. If you put a carbon tax, or the alternative being permits, tradable emission permits, cap and trade, et cetera, if you do that, it's pretty simple economics. You will see a change in the demand structure. And, you know, there's a famous Harvard economist who has consultant with the Bush, the George W. Bush administration, who has said that, this will – you know, if we put a price on carbon, it will decrease. Because it percolates through. It costs more for the companies. That means that other up and coming companies who can provide cheaper energy can outcompete them. You sort of see that with Elon Musk and what he's doing here in California with Solar City, with Tesla vehicles. There are these opportunities that arise, and they're already there. And imagine how many more opportunities there would be for the Elon Musks, the entrepreneurs of the world, if we were to level the playing field completely. So it does work. And a price on carbon is part of the solution. There are other things that we need to do. We obviously need to deal with our international partners in good faith. We need to show respect for the other nations of the world who are trying to deal with this problem. And the U.S. needs to reassert a leadership role rather than being the only nation in the world under Donald Trump not committed to the Paris Accord. We're now literally – we've gone from being a leader under President Obama where we reached an agreement with China to lower carbon emissions, the two largest emitters on the planet, and that agreement created the environment where the Paris Accord was possible. So we went from a leadership role to now being the only country in the world. And let me stress that, the only country in the world. Syria having been the one last holdout, they are now on board. We're the only country in the world under Trump not committed to meeting our obligations under the Paris Accord. That has to change. We need to be a good faith partner in the world community.
What else would you like to see? I mean, we hear lots of talk about electric cars, wind, solar. What else would you like to see?
Yeah, I think that part of it is changing the culture. You know, there's a role for sort of personal responsibility, and there are lots of things that we can do as consumers that there are no regrets actions. There are things that we can do that make us healthier. They save us money, bicycling to work rather than driving to work, buying less energy-intensive appliances and vehicles. There are all these things that we can do that make us happier and healthier and save us money, and they make a difference on this problem. And that – to get people to do those things, you have to sort of change the culture a little bit as well.
Reuters had a piece recently, Trump's EPA aims to replace Obama-era climate and water regulations, and here's the lead. The EPA will replace Obama-era carbon and clean water regulations and open up a national debate on climate change in 2018, part of a list of priorities for the year that also includes fighting lead contamination in public drinking water. Scott Pruitt gave an interview to Reuters and said that this is the plan. They're going to kill regulations that the administration believes are, quote, too broad. I mean, the clean water regulations? Yeah.
Well, keep in mind, Scott Pruitt is basically an agent of the Koch brothers, extremely close ties to the Koch brothers. And the reason he's EPA administrator is because the Koch brothers initially were sort of skeptical about Donald Trump. And clearly there was this arrangement reached where they would get behind him and his presidency, and in return he would appoint their preferred individuals to cabinet-level positions. And that's why we have Scott Pruitt in the EPA.
Do you have any inside contacts? I mean, is Trump involved in the decision-making process on these issues, or does it come from Heritage and the Koch brothers?
Yeah, I think Trump has essentially outsourced policy to the conservative billionaire funders that funded his campaign. In my view, Trump probably has little understanding or opinion in reality when it comes to matters like climate change. But he recognizes that to remain in power and to have the support of sort of mainstream conservatives, he needs to be facilitating their agenda. And that's what we're seeing. While the Trump sideshow proceeds and distracts all of us with his latest antics as they play out in the 24-hour news cycle, sort of more quietly, what we're seeing is Republicans actually executing this deregulatory agenda, congressional Republicans working, in essence, together with Trump administration officials in dismantling environmental protections and putting in place additional incentives for fossil fuel interests. That's all happening, and it's all happening sort of somewhat under the radar screen while we are distracted by the clown show of Donald Trump.
Daniel Giorgiani is a longtime advisor to Charles Koch, and now he is the Department of Interior's principal deputy solicitor.
Of course. You can go right on down the list. What we are right now under Trump is actually the United States of Koch. And not just the Koch brothers, but some of the other billionaire plutocrats who are basically running our country now.
Do you think the media are being straight with the public about that fact?
I don't think that they are. I think there's far too little discussion of that. And while they are sort of focused, again, on the sideshow of Trump, they're really giving a free pass to congressional Republicans and conservative interest groups that are slowly executing this extremely dangerous agenda of eradicating basic protections of our environment and of our liberties, in fact. A party that was supposed to be about liberty and freedom now actually working against individual liberty and freedom.
What do you think is most effective at this point? You have written about the March for Science that we saw last year. A massive march of scientists came out all around the world, even in the most remote parts of the world. What do you think is most effective as people try to decide what to do about all of this?
Yeah, I think it's important that scientists be willing to participate in this discussion. And too often, scientists have shied away from any sort of matters of politics or policy. Many scientists sort of feel that their role is just to do the science under the assumption that, good policy will happen if we just do the work necessary to inform policy. And that's a naive view, because we understand that there are bad faith actors who are doing everything they can to ensure that policy is not informed by the best available science, but instead by, the interests of, industry special interests. So scientists, I wrote an op-ed a few years ago in the New York Times, the title of which was, "If You See Something, Say Something," of course, drawing upon the motto of our Department of Homeland Security. But the point being that as scientists studying these problems, we are seeing something. We see this threat, and it would be a dereliction of our responsibility not to speak out and to inform. And that doesn't mean prescribing policy. That doesn't mean scientists saying, here's the bill that we need to pass. Here's the instrument that we need to use for pricing carbon. I'm happy to leave that to policymakers as long as policy is informed by an objective acceptance of what the science has to say about the reality and the risks of climate change. And the problem is that it isn't right now. We don't have that good faith political debate that we ought to be having.
Well, and the oil and gas industry doesn't leave that to policymakers. They write the bills, right?
Absolutely. And Scott Pruitt, as the Attorney General of Oklahoma, was famous for allowing industry special interests to ghostwrite his bills for him. Mm-hmm. So while it had Scott Pruitt's name on it, it was written by natural gas interests and coal interests and polluting interests.
Since you are a scientist, Michael Mann, I just want you to, in our last 30 seconds, what are you working on right now, or what is that one question that you hope to really tackle this year?
Well, I'm extremely interested in some of the subtle ways that climate change is impacting extreme weather events. And much of the research that I've been doing lately is actually relates to sort of, you know, I got my training as a physicist at UC Berkeley back in the 1980s. I was an applied math and physics double major at UC Berkeley and started out doing research in physics. And my work in climate has sort of led me now back into some of my sort of physics upbringing and background, where we're looking at subtle ways that we talked about the jet stream. And how climate change may be influencing the jet stream. Well, some of those influences can actually be framed in terms of the physics of waveguides. The coaxial cables that we use for our television signals that funnel electromagnetic waves in a direct line that gives us a strong cable signal. Mm. The atmosphere under certain circumstances can act as a waveguide. It basically directs and amplifies these wave disturbances. Only we're not talking about the electromagnetic waves that are our cable signal for our TVs. We're talking about the atmospheric jet stream waves that travel along and bring us extreme weather. And so we're looking at how that behavior of the atmosphere may explain some of the most profound extreme weather events we've seen in recent years. And there does seem to be a direct relationship. But to understand it, we actually have to do some pretty fundamental physics.
Hmm. Well, we'd love to have you back. I think I love the passion that you have surrounding the science, the actual work that you want to be doing. It'd be great to have you back to talk about what we are now learning about these extreme weather events.
We'd love to do that.
Michael Mann is professor of atmospheric science at Penn State, author of three books. His most recent is The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. He co-authored that book with Tom Tolles. Michael Mann is in town to receive an award for outstanding climate science communication. Michael Mann, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls One Planet series. It's been 45 years since the Supreme Court decided the landmark Roe v. Wade case, which legalized abortion in the U.S. and gave women more control over their reproductive choices. The decision also lifted many women out of poverty. Since then, Republicans have enacted extreme policies that restrict access to abortion and other reproductive care. On the next Your Call, we'll speak with women who remember what life was like when abortion was illegal. Join the conversation with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.